Mr. Ray, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
May it please I'm sorry, I should have mentioned which case. 19-1256 U.S. v. Robinson.
May it please the court. My name is Ryan Ray, and I represent the defendant and appellant, Jahlil Robinson. And I'll be asking respectfully to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This court should reverse Mr. Robinson's convictions and sentence for several grounds set forth in our briefing, the most principal of which involve two issues that I would like to spend my time with the court today discussing, namely whether 18 U.S.C. Section 1591A requires proof of an intended commercial sex act with a minor while that person is in fact a minor. And if so, whether the government presents sufficient evidence of trial that Mr. Robinson had that intent. And also the second issue is whether the district court should have presented the question of whether Mr. Robinson was entrapped on the 1591A count to the jury, because that was a factual question in this case. Now, there are many federal cases involving undercover law enforcement officers posing online as young women that communicate with men about sex, but this case presents a unique factual situation as far as I have seen in the case law, which is that the agent here began saying, "I am over 18. He was on a platform that you had to be 18 to join, and the profile created says, "I am 18. And Mr. Robinson communicated under those auspices for a number of months over many, many, many online communications. And it was only later that the agent reversed course and indicated that that was not the case, and that this online persona hadn't quite reached the age of 18. Now, at that point, Mr. Robinson says that he expressed his hesitation, and he says repeatedly that the prostitution-related activities would not occur until the individual had reached the age of 18.
So, counsel, accepting as true your statement that the government represented that the person he was communicating with was 18, what would the result be if your client didn't believe the government's representation and, in fact, suspected the person was underage all along?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. I think that we would look at that objectively. But Your Honor, I would also say that Mr. Robinson testified at trial that he believed this individual was 18, and there were numerous things in the online exchanges indicating that he believed this person was 18. And respectfully, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any evidence that he believed the contrary.
How about his message that you look kind of young, might have to see some ID?
And I think, Your Honor, that's an indication that he wanted to be sure he was communicating with someone who was in fact 18. I don't believe it's the contrary. And then in addition, Your Honor, I would say in any event, what he made clear was that the commercial sex acts would not occur until this individual achieved the age of 18. And that is the distinction that matters for our principal issues presented to the court. And so the question really does become, is how does the court interpret 16-1591A? And we respectfully submit that it must be that the defendant intends that the person will be caused to engage in a commercial sex act while the person has not attained the age of 18. And that is true for a number of reasons. As this court...
Counsel, well, That was the government's theory of the case, was it not? In closing argument and so on, its position was that defendant was guilty of transporting her or arranging for her travel in interstate commerce to commit commercial sex acts while still a minor. Isn't that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So I'm not quite sure why you're arguing that legal issue. The question is whether there's sufficient evidence to support a verdict on that theory, isn't it?
That for our sufficiency of the evidence argument, that's correct, Your Honor. And this also affects our entrapment position as well. Okay. Because if the intent was not to engage in the Commercial Sex Act until after the age of 18, and that was Mr. Robinson's intent, and that's what the statute requires, then there was at least a fact question in this case of whether the conduct of the government affected whether the position of, is this going to happen with a minor? And if that is not, if Mr. Robinson's intent was all along to wait until the age of majority, well, he was convicted of violating a statute that we respectfully submit, Your Honor, requires intent to engage in that conduct while a minor. And we believe there was not sufficient evidence of his intent to engage in that conduct with this individual while a minor, and that there was a fact question here as to whether he was ensnared into that situation by conduct of the government agent. And so that there is both a sufficiency of the evidence issue, and there is also an entrapment issue presented. And I think both of those respectfully turn on the interpretation of 1591A that we are advancing. And we would respectfully submit that our interpretation is correct. As this court noted in the Duong case, this was added to the United States Code to criminalize conduct with children. That is what the statutory title says. And so we respectfully submit that there has to be that level of intent, and that the only evidence that the jury could rely on for that is simply speculative and involves the jury just engaging in inference upon inference. And
let me ask about that. Wasn't there evidence that he told her she'd have to get a fake ID and he would help her with that?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. But that's pretty good
evidence, isn't it? Why would he want to do that if he wasn't going to have her engage in criminal conduct until she was 18?
Well, Your Honor, as the case agent himself conceded, there are a number of reasons that people would need identification, not beyond engaging in a commercial sex act. They could use it to get government benefits. They could use it to identify themselves in a number of things in our society.
Was there anything to suggest that that was your client's intent? The only thing they were talking about was commercial sex acts.
And Your Honor,
go ahead.
Respectfully, Mr. Robinson was making clear that that would happen after she attained the age of majority. And in Nevada, where frankly that activity is legal, at least in some parts of that state.
Why would she need a fake ID because of her age, if she wasn't going to use it until she was 18? I don't understand that.
Well, like I said, Your Honor, there could be issues of travel. There could be issues.
But they didn't discuss any of that, did they?
They were in fact discussing travel, Your Honor. Yeah.
She didn't need to be 18 to get on a bus, did she?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but I think as an absolute matter, but I think certainly that that there could be people inquiring about that. There could be people that wanted to see identification. Frankly, law enforcement often wants to and has the right to see identification from people. There's a number of reasons, and Your Honor, the case agent in this case, in fact, conceded at the trial that there were a number of reasons that are permissible and lawful that would be the case. That may not necessarily be a commercial sex act of any kind.
Mr. Ray, on the entrapment issue, after Mr. Robinson learned that Nikki was 17, he continued to recruit her to come to California. You would agree with that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Where is the evidence of inducement for entrapment? At one point, the confidential source said, "I'm actually 17," and then Mr. Robinson continued repeatedly to make arrangements for her to come to California, and I'm trying to see or understand your argument to support inducement for entrapment.
And I would say, Your Honor, the inducement issue we have is twofold. It's the misrepresentation that this person is in fact 18 years of age. This court's recognized the misrepresentation in Ortiz and other cases, and the cultivation of a friendship on that false premise that this person is in fact an adult. And Your Honor, also,
but doesn't inducement require showing of some kind of coercion or pressure? Where's the pressure in this person saying, you know, I know I posted that I'm 18, but actually I'm really 17. How does that put any pressure on Mr. Robinson? He could have walked away at that point.
Well, Your Honor, but he also made clear that the commercial sex acts would not take place until this person was 18, and that was the premises.
Well, that isn't my question. I'm just looking for that element of entrapment. You seem to be going back to your sufficiency of the evidence argument.
And Your Honor, I would say that this court has recognized that misrepresentations about material facts and this cultivation of a friendship to arrange the circumstances of the crime, and this is an infinitely more serious crime. There was someone in this judicial district that was around the same time that was sentenced to 1 year in prison for communicating with someone that was 18. So this change in age is government creation of a much more serious offense under these circumstances.
One last entrapment question. If I understand your argument, or at least one of your arguments, it's that the district court in declining to give the instruction did not view the evidence in light most favorable to the defendant. What specific evidence on entrapment do you think the district court viewed incorrectly?
It is rejecting Mr. Robinson's testimony that he lacked the intent to engage in the conduct required by 1591 is properly construed. It's really his testimony about what the circumstances are and what the his meaning and intent in these communications was.
An example, just what's your best example from his testimony?
That clearly there were a number of occasions, Your Honor, where he said, I did not intend any prostitution to be taking place.
Did he say that? Did he use those words?
Yes, he did, Your Honor, in his testimony. He did, in fact, use that, you know, that's cited in our brief, Your Honor, it is. And I would respectfully request to reserve the remainder of my time if I could.
Yes, counsel. That'll be fine. Mr. Gruwell, please.
May it please the court, Bishop Gruwell, on behalf of the United States. I think I'll briefly address the entrapment issue and then probably spend the majority of my time discussing the sufficiency issue. On the entrapment issue, Judge Matheson, there isn't any evidence of inducement because inducement does require some sort of pressure. Yes, false representations, building a friendship can be the basis for creating that inducement, but then you have to be coaxing them or goading them or putting some sort of pressure on them. And I think the case law is clear about that. Otherwise, anytime we have an agent go undercover in a drug operation or anything like that, there'd be an entrapment instruction. And that's not the case. What we have to have is some evidence that the government was using either that friendship relationship or the false best representation to create pressure on the defendant that would overcome a law-abiding citizen's will when it comes to actually causing a crime. And if you look at the conversations between them, there's no pressure on either the interstate commerce element that he raises or the age element. Interstate commerce, right at the beginning of the conversation, he is the one who's talking about, we'll travel state to state doing this business. And then when she starts talking about, well, yeah, I'd like to get out of Colorado, she's not pressuring him to get her out of Colorado. She's just going along with the plan that he's already set forth. When it comes to the age, yes, there was a misrepresentation about her age because only someone 18 or older can get on the website. The agent here didn't directly say, I'm 18 to Mr. Robinson. That was simply on the profile. And then the second there's an opportunity to talk about age in a normal context, he says he's 17 right from there, and there's no hesitation from Mr. Robinson at that point. In fact, within an hour is about when he's raising this point about, they're going to need to get her a fake identification. And so I think there's simply nothing on the inducement element. I can talk about the predisposition, but I think because there's nothing on the inducement, I don't think I need to discuss that unless the court has questions about it. I would then turn to the sufficiency of the evidence issue. And I would note that first, you don't need to go to the government's statutory interpretation argument because I think there is sufficient factual evidence even under Mr. Robinson's theory of the case here, even under his theory that we had to somehow show that he knew a commercial sex act would occur before she turned 18. And I think there are four categories of evidence that support that. First of all, we've got his statements between him and Nikki on the text messages and the phone conversations, and I will discuss those. But we also have the age deception category. This includes the fake ID, his comments that they needed to be hella discreet to watch out for her nosy relatives and nosy greyhound. And then we have the case agent's testimony, Agent Speedy, who testifies that in his experience, whenever somebody is trafficking minors and bringing them across state lines, they don't wait for them to mature for the sex acts. And that experience is certainly something that can be looked at. And then the government's case here, yes, the theory below was this theory that goes with his interpretation of the statute. And he testified himself getting up there and saying, no, I didn't plan to do this. Well, the jury didn't believe him. And while that credibility determination can't be the sole basis for sufficiency of the evidence, it's certainly something you can mix in there. I want to turn back to those statements because there are a couple more of them that went to this. First of all, this is page supplemental volume one, pages 91, 92, and 93. First of all, she says that she doesn't want to send him naked pictures. And he responds, once we're together, there's going to be more than just taking pics, suggesting that there would be underage sex. And a few minutes later on 92 and 93, she's talking about concerns about friends who've gotten in trouble, or she's heard about people getting in trouble for sending child pornography. And his response is that child pornography is going to be minor compared to what they're doing. Well, a jury could infer from that what was going to make child pornography minor, it was something much, much more illegal, and that would be underage sex. And finally, we had his testimony that he was going to make her perfection. And as our expert pointed out here, you can't become perfection at being a prostitute without practicing that ahead of time. So I think when you take all of those things together, we had sufficient evidence that a jury could infer that he was going to prostitute her before she turned 18. Yes, there could be other legitimate reasons or perhaps other illegitimate reasons for getting a fake identification. But as you pointed out, Judge Hartz, this was all in the context about them starting a commercial sex operation together. And so it's fair for a reasonable jury to infer that that was the reason that they needed to get a fake identification.
Could the jury have concluded based on their own experience and the officer's testimonies that someone in Mr. Robinson's position isn't going to pay for a minor to move and live with them for 6 months and not engage them in prostitution?
I think they certainly could hear when you also have his testimony where on cross-examination, he had no explanation about how he was going to cover her shelter or the like during that interim time. And so I think the jury could certainly draw that from that, and they could draw it from the fact that, you know, he's spending $200 and some on a bus ticket to bring her out there. So I think those are other facts that can be considered and inferences drawn for the jury. Judge Hartz, did you have a question?
I'm curious about your alternative theory.
Mm-hmm.
That was not argued to the jury, was it?
It was not, but the United States versus Masaccio opinion from the United States Supreme Court says when we're dealing with sufficiency of the evidence, we're not concerned about the jury instructions and the theory. We're concerned about what the law requires.
Well, then you've required us to decide whether your alternative theory is correct. Because if it's incorrect, we have to reverse. Because you've just said the jury could have convicted on that theory. And if the jury could have convicted on that theory, and that theory is illegitimate, we don't know whether the jury convicted on that theory, and we have to reverse. Isn't that right?
I don't think so.
Go ahead.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the question is, could a reasonable jury conclude that? And it's not, did this jury conclude it? It's based on the facts, did this jury conclude it? And so if you disagree with our interpretation and you say his interpretation is right, then you certainly can look at those facts. And if you find that our interpretation is right, then you can look at the facts that show that, in fact, he admitted on the stand.
If two theories are presented to the jury and there's sufficient evidence of both, and the jury convicts, but one of the theories is illegitimate, I think the precedent says we have to reverse. I thought it was kind of strange that you would present this argument that could require reversal when there's clearly sufficient evidence under the theory that was presented to the jury.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, because there's sufficient evidence, at the very least, there's sufficient evidence under both theories here.
Yeah, I'm assuming there's sufficient evidence under both theories.
Go ahead. Only one theory was presented to the jury.
You're trying to have it both ways. If the jury could reasonably have convicted on both theories, and one theory isn't supported by sufficient evidence, then we assume that the jury convicted on the other. But if we have one of the theories is illegitimate, not lawful, not a proper interpretation of the statute, then we have to reverse. And you're saying, well, we know that the jury didn't convict on this illegitimate theory. That's what you're having to say, but you're also arguing the opposite of that.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, if the illegitimate theory actually requires more than the legitimate theory.
Well, here the illegitimate theory requires less.
Well, which one would you think is the illegitimate theory, Your Honor, right? I mean, that's kind of the question, and I think...
The only one that's in question, where the legitimacy is in question, is your new theory that... It would violate the statute for him to arrange for her transportation when she's a minor, even though she won't engage in commercial sex until she's reached 18.
If our new theory is illegitimate, if our new theory is the one that the sex act doesn't have to occur until they're after 18 is wrong, that means we have to have a sex act before 18. That's the theory that was presented to the jury and that they convicted on. And so, and in this case, that actually requires more because it would require that she be underage before the age of 18. So I don't think the way you're presenting it, that's the one that you would be calling the illegitimate theory. And if it's the reverse, if in fact our theory about the statute is the correct theory and it simply wasn't presented, we have an admission from him on the stand that that's the correct theory. And under Masaccio, you would then consider that theory and you'd go with our admission. But if under Masaccio, you think our other one's wrong, you think that that one is correct and the theory that you had to have less here, you had to have him convicted before he's 18, is the wrong one, that requires more. And there was more here, and that was the theory presented to the jury. So I guess I would respectfully disagree with how the analysis works in this case.
Well, we can chew on that later. Let me ask you about your evidentiary issue. You said, sure. You mentioned the expert testimony that The officer had never known of anyone engaged in this profession who had taken on a girl under 18 and then kept her from engaging in commercial sex until she was 18. And that strikes me as very questionable expert testimony. You're saying that in his opinion, these people didn't have that intent, and therefore the defendant here didn't have that intent. And I suspect the next time he's called as a witness, he'll say the same thing because he didn't believe Mr. Robinson had that intent. Do you have any support for that specific type of evidence?
Your Honor, that isn't actually brought up here. He objects to Agent Tagaman's testimony here. He doesn't object anywhere, even in his appeal brief, to Agent Spivey's testimony. That testimony occurs at Volume 6, 482, 489. That issue simply isn't in the briefing when it comes to that particular testimony. He has waived any issue regarding that particular thing. And because he didn't object to it below, he would have to argue plain error about it. But given that he hasn't even raised it at all, I guess that would be a double waiver of that particular issue.
Well, I'm concerned that you rely on it. Are you conceding that that was improper testimony?
The testimony about his experience.
I was asking whether you are familiar with any authority allowing that sort of testimony.
I don't think that it's improper testimony here. I'm not sure which case I would need. I can certainly try to find a 28J on that. Given that he didn't raise it with respect to that particular testimony, I didn't pull a case for that. But the notion that an officer can testify about his experience, that, you know, if he's done numerous of these particular trafficking operations and every time or the vast majority of the time, I think here he says he hasn't had one where it didn't occur, where they're trafficking them right away, that I think that is proper experience testimony, especially he's not testifying about necessarily the defendant's mindset when he says that. He's testifying about how he experiences things coming across.
He's saying no one else has had that mindset, and you're suggesting we just therefore draw the inference that Mr. Robinson didn't have that mindset. That strikes me as...
And you certainly don't need that testimony for the sufficiency to hold, given that you have the numerous statements between Nikki and Mr. Robinson, given the fake ID, given him testifying on the stand against the government's theory and the jury not finding him credible. So you certainly don't have to rely on that for sufficiency of the evidence. But to the extent that particular expert issue...
You mentioned investigator, is it Tangeman? Is that how you pronounce it?
He's the expert, and right. Spivey was a case agent.
No, I understand. And the issue that was raised about his testimony was interspersing fact testimony and expert testimony together. That's the objection. Do you agree that could have been confusing to the jury?
I do, Your Honor.
Are jury instructions enough to guard against that confusion?
I think they are, Your Honor. I think we regularly we figure that juries follow their instructions, and all the case law that he cites are talking about jury instructions to fix that problem. And the jury instructions here actually went further than was required. Given that
aren't there some courts that are now calling for some kind of bifurcation of the presentation between fact and expert testimony?
There was some case law suggesting that might be a proper way to do it. This court has said, you know, we're going to look at that on a case by case basis, but it certainly for plain error would require them to have raised that objection and then get plain error that way. And there's no case law requiring it here or suggesting that a judge needs to sua sponte say, okay, we're going to bifurcate this now that this testimony is going on here. What Judge Brimmer did was he said, okay, here's the stuff that's opinion testimony. All the rest is fact testimony. And he cleared that up for the jury and told them how they could use the opinion testimony.
I was interested in your response because we're seeing this issue more often these days, this interspersing of testimony from the investigator in a criminal case.
And best practices might be well to try and separate the two more in the testimonial process, Your Honor. Unless the court has further questions, I see that I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ray, you have a minute or so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very briefly on the issue of entrapment, I would respectfully invite the court to examine the Wynn case that we cited. I know, but I think both parties did in our reply brief, and what the court there, what was justified in entrapment instruction. It wasn't a lot. Your Honor, Judge Matheson, I would invite the court to look at the sites on page 14 of our reply brief about the testimony of Mr. Robinson, that would support, his views about, what was going to happen and what was going to, be his intent regarding age.
And I would, Mr. Ray, I was confusing this test. I think I was, had in mind not so much his testimony at trial, but did he say something during any of these exchanges with the confidential source to make it clear that that was not his intent?
May I respond, Your Honor? I do see I'm out of time. I do believe, Your Honor, that in our briefing that we have set that out, that there were statements in the underlying text messages or social media messages, as they may be, in which he made that clear.
Further question, Judge Matheson?
No, nothing further for me.
Judge Carson?
Okay. No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Mr. Ray, you're excused.